You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Today, my guest is Philip Gates. Philip is an innovative director and performer and a really hardworking artist. I'm so excited to hear about his process and experiences making work in New York City. Phil and I met a few years ago when he was producing a play that I was in, and lucky for me, he and playwright Adam Scott Mazur then asked me to be a part of an exploratory workshop. We devised material based on the true story of the Donner Party, which if you don't know what that is, please go Google it. I did not know at the time, and it's a crazy true story. And now, 2 years later, we're about to open our second run of a play called The Tower, which Adam wrote based on that material. It is immersive and bloody and fun, and I hope you'll join us. You'll hear more about that play and process from Philip over the course of this podcast. But if you have a chance, please come check it out. It's going to be at Here Art Center, December 4th through 19th, 2015. This is the first time I'm talking with someone that I'm currently in the process of working with on The Compass, so I'm excited about that. I hope you enjoy the 14th episode of The Compass. So we're just going to dive in.
Great.
What is the dark side for you as an artist, and how do you try to keep yourself out of it?
Sure. Well, it's funny, like, right after, you know, we scheduled this conversation today, you know, I was on Facebook and the New York Times, you know, some sponsored post from the New York Times came up, and it was this article that was like, "Do you have imposter syndrome?" And I looked at that and I was like, this is exactly what I'm going to talk about.
I feel like that's only been a term recently, but I totally connect with it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then I read the piece and apparently it stems from some, I guess, a study. It was like in the 70s or something that they actually coined this term. But yeah, but basically it's despite all evidence and affirmation from other people and external sources that you are intelligent, creative, capable, you feel like a total fraud.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And that is definitely sort of what I struggle with, and that's sort of my main demon, I guess I would say. The biggest, scary, the big boss.
That's how it manifests.
The big boss. Yeah, that's how it manifests for me, is just thinking, is just being in a room with a bunch of people and going, I don't belong here. Yeah. Like, these people are all so smart.
I'm the weak link.
And so capable. Exactly. And like, I'm not prepared. Like, everybody is more, everybody's done more than me. Everybody has more to contribute than me. Like, where do I get off thinking, and especially as a director, you know, where do I get off thinking that I, can lead these people? Yeah, like, who voted me in charge? No one.
Yeah, that is interesting, since you're in a power, like, a position of authority.
Yeah.
It must be even more intense.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I, you know, that, it strikes me as well when I'm performing as well, for sure. But it's definitely, it's at its most intense when I'm directing, whether it's in the rehearsal room or meetings. That's the demon. And you know, And I do know, like, at my base level, I feel confident and I feel capable, and I know that I'm doing what I should be doing, mm-hmm. In life. But yeah, but that guy, that voice is just the worst.
So how do you find yourself trying to talk your way out of that?
Well, I mean, I try to give myself permission to feel that way, and not because if it doesn't really work to just ignore it
yeah.
or to tell it to go away, because that kind of just makes it stronger for me. Mm-hmm. I feel like sitting in it and being like, you know, that's okay. And also reminding myself that most other people in the room probably also feel this way. But just knowing that, you know, I don't have to have all the answers, and that part of my job is to fill the room with other creative, capable people and to create an environment in which we can all work together and fail together, and that yeah. that's fine.
and that it's only going to make the end product better.
Yeah.
Everybody in the room is
yeah.
at a great level.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and everybody says, like, you know, do be the weakest person in the room, like work with people who are better than you because it pushes you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, I try to remind myself of that as well, that I'm yeah. just, that in letting these feelings in, I'm actually pushing myself to be stronger.
I feel like after a while, too, you kind of figure out that, oh, this, I've felt this feeling before.
Yes.
And it will pass.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I have this feeling that I call the fog that always,
okay.
yeah, that, and it will settle upon me
uh-huh.
during production. Usually, like, depends how long it is, but it, you know,
yeah.
it's always the same place, whether it's like a 3-day process or a 6-week process or what, or a year or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I get to the same place and I start out thinking, this is great. It's going to be different this time. I'm so prepared. I know what I'm doing. Like, I've had all these ideas. And I'm ready, and I know that the fog is coming. I know it's coming, and every time it comes, it still feels like the first time. I
yeah.
still have those feelings of, I can't see this play. I don't know what story I'm telling. I don't know what we're doing here.
Right.
But then, and you just, you know, you just power through it, and it does, the fog lifts. And I go through this every time,
right.
and yet it's still every time when it comes, it feels like a new thing, which
yeah.
is remarkable.
Yeah, I totally go through that too.
Yeah. But,
and then you realize later, like, oh, that must just be part of the process. But in the moment, it's like, oh no, this is real.
Right.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And yes, exactly. And with some distance, you know that that's part of the process that you
right.
have to have.
Right.
Like, you, I mean, what would a process be like where you knew exactly what you were doing every step of the way? I mean, that would be so boring, actually.
Probably.
Like, because then you would just take you know, whatever you're making will just be exactly what you think it's going to be at the beginning. And there's no journey. There's no discovery. There's no
yeah.
surprises. You just are, it's, that's like assembly line art,
mm-hmm.
basically. You're following the IKEA, you know, instructions of assembly to, you know, put together something that will look lovely, but
yeah, probably be pretty boring.
Right. Yeah. So I know that it's necessary to have those moments, because out of that, when you're struggling through the fog and just sort of reaching out blindly,
mm-hmm.
you're gonna hit something. You're gonna stumble upon something that you wouldn't have found.
Right.
Because you get lost a little bit and you wander down this way, and then you say, oh, over here, here's this other solution, or here's this other idea that's actually exciting. So yeah, it's just, you know, it's just reminding myself of that.
I mean, speaking of having a lot of wonderful people in the room together, that was something I wanted to ask you about, because you strike me as someone who has all of these really amazing collaborators.
Mm.
I've been so interested and impressed with everyone that I've gotten to meet through you, that you're creating the piece we're
oh,
working
wow.
on together with
yeah.
and like how long have you been in New York now?
7 years.
7 years, yeah. What has that been like since you moved here, like creating that community for yourself? And what does that give you as an artist? Because as a director, you do need to be like part of a team, like the head of the team.
Yeah, yeah. I can't create anything really by myself. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, and I have heard that before.
Yeah, well, it's
actually. Well, every time I think, huh, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's sort of like, why, how could you do this without that? Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I have a like super articulate answer for you about, well, my magic touch.
No, I'm sure
like,
a lot of it has been happenstance. Yeah, that exactly. You met this person through this, and it's just
yeah. I mean, when I moved here, I knew I think exactly two people in New York. And it just slowly spread out from those two people. It's like I can trace pretty much everybody back, you know, it's like a family tree or something.
Yeah.
A family tree of collaborative connection. It's mostly, honestly, it's like, who do I like? It's like, who
do you want to spend that who many do hours
I
want? With?
Exactly. Exactly. Who do I want to spend time with? And generally, the people that I want to spend time with in my life are also creative, capable people. Right. I feel like my friendships and my working relationships, I'm lucky in that they feel really integrated. Mm-hmm. and generally, the people that I like spending time with discover that they like spending time with each other, and then you know, and then fruitful. One of my favorite things as a director is seeing people that worked on one of my shows go on to collaborate on other projects.
Really?
Of their own. Yeah. Yeah. It makes me feel it's like a theater yenta or something, you know? But it makes me feel.
That makes sense.
I feel very warm.
I feel that way in my life. Like when I introduce friends from different circles and they end up having their own relationship, I'm like, oh yeah, I
yeah,
love that. It makes
yeah.
me so happy.
Yeah, and like you've there are so many people in this city, and I'm sure there are so many people, you know, that we don't even know that we would love, mm-hmm. and we would connect with, but you're never gonna meet them. So I don't know. I kind of feel like doing the kind of work that I do, and one of the reasons that I think I direct and that I work in theater at all, you know, a collaborative art form versus something where I'm working more individually is connecting people and in building community, and that community slowly, you know, expands the longer I'm here and the more people that I meet and the more people get to know each other. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
The only other director I've interviewed is my friend Lori, and, I asked her, I was like, I know for playwrights and for directors, you can kind of be classified by the business as an emerging director,
yes,
an
word.
Emerging playwright uh-huh. forever.
Yeah. Yeah, you
What's
can be...
What's that been like for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you can be, I don't know, people who seem like they're like pretty okay as far as like they're getting productions at legit theaters and like mm-hmm. and they'll get like grants or awards that label them emerging.
Right. And you're like,
and
you
I
have
think,
a pretty
well,
good career.
Interesting. If you haven't emerged, then God help us all. Because,
what am I doing?
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't
just because I know there's only one director usually on all productions, so I'm sure it's very competitive.
Yeah.
And to be kind of looked at as a beginner all the time, have you run into that?
I don't know. I feel like I'm not, there. I mean, there are a couple of paths, I think, to emerging, to the process of emerging. There are a couple of sort of ways, paths that you can follow as a director. I mean, uh-huh. you can assist a lot. And you can sort of become known that way. You can work at the established theaters and work with the established directors and just become a known quantity that way. And then eventually, you know, you have this amazing network of support for your own work. And I have friends who have been kind of going that route and mm-hmm. have had some amazing, amazing assisting opportunities. Or you can kind of just completely do your own thing and like, and you know, maybe start a company or just come right out of the gate with a really strong voice and aesthetic, mm-hmm. That's unique. And so right away people go, oh, like you're this thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I've had a hard time because I don't feel like either of those is quite the path for me. I've had some great assisting opportunities. I've been David Adjmi's assistant for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. And having a long-term sort of mentor-assistant relationship has been incredibly rewarding.
Right.
To be able to work with him on a couple of processes and a couple of plays.
And not just one production.
Yeah, yeah. And two productions of the same play, even. That's been really valuable. I think I've... And he's really the only person that I've assisted in New York. Mostly, I worked on one show at Columbia with Adriana Baer, mm-hmm. who was fantastic. Now she works in Portland now. What am I saying?
So you've kind of taken a different route then.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I have not been interested, for better or for worse. I have not right. been interested in spending a lot of time working my way up in the sort of established places, mm-hmm. but nor, you know, I started a company when I moved here, and worked with them pretty much exclusively for the first couple of years that I was here. And at a certain point that felt not quite right either. I felt like I was tying myself too soon to this one mm-hmm. very particular, kind of work or this particular kind of voice. And so not really feeling like either of those paths is right has been difficult because I feel like I'm really sort of like bushwhacking out right. there. Like, like nobody is doing, there's no path specifically for me to follow. Like there's yeah. nobody really that I look to and think like, oh, like I want to be,
that's
exactly what I want. Although also I think when you were in your conversation with Jude, mm-hmm. I feel like I remembered something where he was saying like, you don't want to do that anyway.
Yeah.
Like you don't want to be like, oh, I'm going to be this person.
Right.
And that
but
really,
when you're in it, you think like, well, that would be much easier if I did do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, why isn't there a model again?
Right.
Like where are the IKEA, like step-by-step, yeah. like assembly instructions for my career? but they're not
there.
This
podcast is sponsored by IKEA.
Yeah. Promotional consideration. Mm. Yeah.
That's
so I guess, I mean, to go back to your, and where we started this with emerging, it's sort of tough to be almost 30 and to still feel like in terms of the industry at large, like,
right.
yeah, who are you?
Right.
But I, at the same time, I feel more comfortable in my place here and I feel more okay with that, than I did, you know, maybe a few years ago and more comfortable with striking out on my own. Looking for opportunities, you know, within established theaters. There are people that I'm hoping will come see the show that we're working on, you know.
Yeah.
But also feeling free to just sort of follow from project to project what seems right for me at the moment and trust that's gonna.
But if it's something that you're passionate about,
yeah,
it's worthwhile.
Yeah, and trust that exactly, yeah. That the passion of the project.
That's
will.
What really like sets yeah. things back on track for me when I think about it. I'm like, well, you know, I'll get down or I'll get to the dark side and I'll be like, actually, like I'm really proud of what I've done
mm-hmm.
in the past few years. Like all the projects I've done, even if they haven't been seen by the people who I wanted to see them or they
right.
haven't been paid the what I wish I were paid to do them. I've done really good work with good people that I love
yeah.
and that I'm proud of. And that's important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very important for me. I mean,
it's a big thing to be able to say. At least you're not doing like, oh, I've been doing extra work, and that's it, and I don't feel creatively fulfilled.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Passion
yeah.
projects.
I guess I've chosen to focus on things that are always personally exciting and personally fulfilling, rather than something that I feel like is going to, you know, quote unquote, advance my career.
Right. But that you might not connect with.
But that I don't connect with. Yeah. And I think, and I mean, I've been, you're catching me. This is. I've been thinking this conversation is happening at a point in my life when I'm really struggling with a lot of these questions, or, yeah, and attempting to, you know, look forward at what I want, you know, the next 10 years of my life to look like, and the container for making my art, and what shape that's going to take, you know, what circumstances do I need to set up for myself,
right,
so that I can work in the way that I find fulfilling. And that's, I mean, and I've sort of settled, it seems very obvious, but making work I like with people I love has really emerged as the priority, like, mm-hmm, as a long-term priority, yeah, more than anything else. And so, of course, now that's leading to me to sort of the micro questions of, where does this happen? Mm-hmm. How do I make this financially sustainable? But I feel like I have my north, the north on the compass, you know, to be on the nose.
That's a big thing to even know that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. But yeah.
What do you do for your day job stuff?
I've been doing restaurant work for the last 5 years.
How does that mesh with the schedule you need to do your artistic stuff?
I mean, it's been pretty great, mostly in flexibility wise. I've also been lucky that apparently people think I'm a good worker. So I've been.
I feel like artists, if they decide to do the job, they're so capable.
Yeah.
So a lot of times people in other industries are like, oh, you really know how to get things done.
Yeah.
And focus and,
yeah,
be effective.
Totally. So I've been lucky that my restaurant jobs have all lasted a long time, and pretty quickly, you know, I build up enough trust that people who are doing the scheduling allow me to take the time that I need, you know, in exchange for, you know, they know that when I'm more available, I'll put in the time. It's a trade-off. I try to make myself as available as possible when I don't have an intensive production schedule, or I'm not I'm working on something that's, you know, more personal and more flexible, so that when I'm in, you know, when I'm in a 6-week rehearsal process that involves, you know, 25 other people and is structured like what we're working on now, that I can go in and be like, listen,
this is what I need.
This is what's happening. So that's been good. You know, I have a sort of love-hate relationship with restaurants and with service particularly, because in some ways I feel that, I mean, that it's actually very much in line with my job as a director, which is to provide a stellar experience, basically. I mean, as a director, I'm kind of in the service business.
Right.
I need to make sure that you know, the audience member, you know, like the diner, like, are you comfortable? Like, what is the ambiance like? What is,
right,
you know, what the pacing of the food coming out? Are you ordering something that you're going to like? Am I making sure that you're trying new things and not just getting the same, like, hamburger every time? You know, what's the balance between letting you discover new things and also making sure that you leave satisfied, mm-hmm, and enriched? So I don't know. So as a server, I mean, I was a server for a long time. Now I'm a host. As a server particularly, you know, that sense of guiding the meal is I think is a lot like directing. And there's something, you know, eating, I mean, that the Food Odyssey play that you were in, which was so lovely, the community and ritual and love around dining is a beautiful thing, and has a lot of crossover, I think, with why we go to the theater and why we make theater.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand,
then you have to be like dragged down every day by the
stuff. Right, exactly. And then there's the nitty gritty stuff, and there's the beautiful, horrible, complicated mess that is, you know, humanity.
Yeah.
and you know, there are absolutely lovely people that I've met, and there are really people who make me question who make me want to just, you know, be a hermit and never interact with anyone again. So there's that. The hours can be draining. That's something that I'm struggling with, you know, right now. It's my job now is long hours. It's great. But it's long hours and it just leaves me tired. So I'm essentially working two full-time jobs right now. And that's not sustainable, frankly, in the long term.
Right.
I'm reaching a point where I think, well, I can't, you know, this has been great for my 20s. It's let me do what I need to do. But as I'm moving, I'm thinking about moving into the next phase, what can I find that's going to nourish me and not take up half my week?
Because, and to give you more than just the bare bones, like, oh, I can pay my bills.
Yeah.
But to give me a savings account and the investments and all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
That adults are supposed to do.
Yeah. All, yes, exactly.
All of those things.
Those things.
Yeah, me too. Well, let's talk about the tower now, because I want to make sure we're going to talk about it. I'm so glad and so thankful that you and Adam invited me to participate like 2 years ago now in this project, because it's been so much fun. That's a really big thing for a director, it seems. It's like having playwrights who you have a partnership with and you can have a relationship with, and that really gives you kind of the longevity of like, oh, I have this person who's always going to, you know, hopefully look to me or like one other person for their work, because we speak the same language.
Yeah.
And it's been so interesting to see you guys develop this piece together from a workshop that Adam then wrote the script afterward from the stuff we created in that. Had you done that before?
No. Not, well, we had, back with Lunar Energy, which was my company that I mentioned earlier, that I started when I moved here, when we were working on Nadia Sepsenwall had the idea to do a updated Three Sisters, which you ended up being in, which was wonderful.
Through some term events,
yeah. And at the beginning of that process, I led a few sort of investigatory workshops into the Chekhov, just to sort of work on, you know, sort of character building and sort of what in the text was interesting.
Mm-hmm. But even that is like based on a different kind of source material than what the tower is.
Yeah. And it wasn't, and it was just really sort of like, you know, it was like 2 or 3 days. It was like once a month. And really Nadia and Tim then went and, you know, sort of, and made their own thing. Whereas the tower was really the first time that I had done something as extensive as that 2 week workshop that we did, to just start from the ground up completely. I mean, Adam had ideas about, you know, the historical figures that he wanted to include and the events and sort of the you know, what the thread was. But we really, and we had met a couple times, you know, the two of us and Maya, who was our historian and dramaturg, who was also, you know, instrumental in figuring out what, you know, the bones of this piece were going to be. But yeah, I mean, we came in into rehearsal. I mean, you remember, we just had a lot of, we threw so much stuff at you guys. It was incredible. I mean, you guys were total champions.
But it worked somehow.
Yeah, it did. It did.
I was impressed with how much material we generated in those 2 weeks.
Yeah. We made a remarkable amount of very diverse stuff.
Some of which is still in the show now.
Some of which is still in the show. And some of which it has been a journey to let go of, actually.
Yeah.
Over the last few iterations of the process. I think it was about 2 weeks ago, Adam cut a line that had come out of a composition that you guys made on the very first day of the very first workshop.
Wow.
And it had been in the script ever since. And we just had this moment of like, it's time.
You get so attached to that stuff.
So I mean, it was pretty fascinating. You know, sort of coming up, Adam and Maya and I, you know, coming up with a container basically, and then you guys filled the containers in this really sort of magical alchemical way. And then Adam, you know, we took that, we had conversations about it. Adam and Maya and I went to Donner Lake, the site where the party was trapped, and that was hugely influential. So yeah, and then that all went into the script. So it's interesting. I mean, I've never before staged a script, because there is a script. I mean, you know, there's a concrete script. It's not,
yeah,
it's not real. It's not a devised piece. You know, we're not. But the script comes from devised exercises,
right.
And the work that we all did together. So it's a totally unique challenge and interesting experience to stage something that now has this very, you know, concrete form and task that must be accomplished, but that has this sort of like bubbling magma underneath of all the ideas and things that came from the devising process. We are not the first people to have ever done this. I mean, we were inspired by Carol Churchill and Joint Stock particularly, and the way that they did, that they had workshops for Cloud Nine.
Oh, I don't know about that history.
Yeah, so Carol Churchill was working with Joint Stock, the company led by Max Stafford Clark, in England in the 70s, and they got together and they had conversations. They talked about gender roles and their own personal experiences, and they did improvisations and character work, and then brought in their own stuff. And then she went away and wrote the play.
Okay.
After these workshops, incorporating a lot of stuff, or a lot of conversations that they had had. Mm. So we were inspired by that process. This is certainly the only time that this is the first time that I've worked that way, but I found it quite fascinating. and I'm working on another play with Claire Kuechel, who's a playwright friend. We started a similar process working on a piece called Lulu is Hungry, mm-hmm. Which is, we started out with Frank Wedekind, his play Lulu, or his Lulu plays rather, because there are several of them. And, you know, this started as just a conversation one night. We were like, let's adapt Lulu. All right, you know, neither of us having read it in, you know, years and years. And then we read it and discovered that we don't like it very much. But in talking and thinking about this piece, we found all these things that we were interested in exploring. And so now we've been having workshops for, you know, over like the end of the summer, the last couple of weeks. And now Claire is going and writing a piece, you know, based off of what we've been talking about. So we have a presentation in December.
One of the things that I still find so effective about the way you work is that you're such a physical director.
Hmm.
And I love that, because I've found myself to be a really physically driven actor as well, at least in, I love to dance and I kind of love getting outside myself in that way. Where does that come from?
Good question.
I just feel like it makes as far as developing these pieces like this, yeah, with the playwrights, it gives it another dimension rather than just sitting around a table and having,
sure,
a table read or like an intellectual conversation about what they might write.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, some of my training, I have a little bit of like Suzuki Viewpoints training background, mm-hmm, when I was in college. And I think okay, here we go. When I was a kid, I had this phase where I wanted to be a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was little and I wanted to take ballet classes. I don't know how old I was, probably like eight or so, seven or eight. And you know, like I was listening to like all the, you know, Tchaikovsky ballets, the Nutcracker and Sleeping Beauty all the time. And, you know, my parents took me to see, you know, Swan Lake for my, you know, birthday when I was seven or eight or something. And I thought I wanted to dance. And so they bought me a ballet class. And I went, and I was the only boy,
mm-hmm,
and I freaked out, and I couldn't do it. I was too nervous. I was too conscious, I guess, of sort of the social, mm-hmm, pressures or conditioning, I guess, of like, oh, you're a boy. Like, and right. I don't know, probably in New York City, there are, you know, little boys taking dance classes everywhere. But in suburban Western, not suburban, and, you know, sort of semi-rural Western Massachusetts, that was definitely not the case. Right. And so I never took the dance class. And I think I let that go for a long time. And I really only discovered, and I was very uncomfortable in my body for most of my adolescence, high school years. Mm-hmm. And then I got to college, and I guess I worked with the director who was my mentor in college. She liked to incorporate a lot of dance into her pieces. And so I started kind of doing this stuff, you know, performing in her shows. And I started to realize that I really enjoyed moving and incorporating that. And so very lately, I've been trying to get back in touch with that part of myself. And yeah. I've been lucky enough to, I met Dan Safer, who runs the company Witness Relocation, on the La Mama Director's Retreat. Mm-hmm. He was a teaching artist. And so I took this amazing workshop that he led, showing us a bunch of his techniques for making movement, and specifically for making movement for non-dancers. Yeah. And how you, as a director, can make movement without formal dance training. Mm-hmm. Which I had been sort of starting to play with in my work, using some mostly viewpoints techniques pulled and slightly adjusted from viewpoints. But then Dan sort of gave me this whole new set of tools for using movement, even if you are not a dancer, and you don't have to be a dancer, and the people you're working with don't have to be dancers. Like, our bodies are beautiful and all move in these wonderful specific ways. And you can just build movement with whatever you're working with in the room, and whoever you have in the room can make something fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. And so working with him, and then I've been lucky enough to get to perform in a couple of his shows as well. And so that's been really great to sort of rediscover that, you know, the repressed 7-year-old ballerina urges finally have an outlet.
I'm so sad I haven't seen you perform yet. Yeah, I really want to.
It'll happen. But yeah, and I guess, I mean, and you were talking about being a physical-based actor. I mean, for me, I would much rather, I think I've used the word container like 18 times in this interview, but I feel like it's my job to provide the container, to provide the structure, and that it's the job of the actor to bring themselves to that and to fill it in with mm-hmm. whatever is happening for you. Right. I've cast an actor because I trust them, and because I find them interesting mm-hmm. as a person. I find them, you know, they're energetically, there's something about them that's interesting mm-hmm. To watch. And so for me, like, it's not my job to get in your head and to mess with what's going on for you and your process internally. Like, right. Of course I'm available to answer questions, or to talk about the character, you know, about the scenes, the dramaturgy, anything that will help you to do that job. But it's not my job to do that work. You right. know, it's my job to empower you to do that work. Mm. And so for me, a lot of the reason that I work, you know, I'm like, okay, this is where you are. This is where you are in this scene. This is the physical journey that you go through in this scene. And like, these are the rules of the scene, or these are the rules of the text that we're working. These are the rules of the text that we're working with. And these are the rules physically that we're working with. I see it as my job to be clear about those, and to make sure that you all are clear about those. And then the rest of it you fill in. Like, that's not really for me to determine. Hmm. I don't know. That's my perspective. Obviously, different people work different ways. But but that's what I'm starting to come to, I think, as my my belief of what my job is personally. I'm not saying all directors, but for me.
No, of course. I guess it's been so poignant for me on this process just because we're dealing with such extreme physical things. We're dealing with the cold. We're dealing with hunger. We're dealing with hallucinatory, psychedelic,
psychedelic dance numbers. Yeah.
So it's just been so apparent to me that, like, oh, he's so good at working this way. And this is, I enjoy this about his directing. I don't know if we were working on an Arthur Miller play together, if it would be a different experience.
Right.
Maybe not.
I don't know.
It would
just
be more subtle.
I don't know either. I have never worked on an Arthur Miller play. I don't know what I would do with an Arthur Miller play, but Ivo Van Hove is having a serious moment right now in New York theater, but his productions, especially the first one that I saw, The Little Foxes.
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh my gosh. That exploded for me, the possibilities of the physical life of a play. And I'm still processing what I learned, like, from that piece and from his work. But just that, like, naturalism, or what am I saying? Extreme physicality can reflect emotional truth. That the emotional truth doesn't have to mean pure realism and naturalism in the physical life of a piece.
Yeah,
like, he had people were, like, clawing the walls and punching each other, and it was just, but it all felt completely motivated and authentic to what was happening between those characters. Yeah. And so that's something that I guess I'm still looking for how I can use that. So yeah, so I don't know what I would do with Arthur Miller, but
one day we'll find out.
Well, yeah. It would probably be The Crucible. It would have to be The Crucible.
Oh, that would be amazing. And, like, I weirdly tied to The Tower, I feel like, in some way.
Yeah, at one point Adam and I were like, what's next? What's next for antimatter? And witches were one of the things that came up. Yeah, I think I have some Salem witch thing in me somewhere. we'll see. TBD.
Well, you said you grew up in Massachusetts.
Yeah. My folks that live in Boston now, so I can go up and...
Yeah. I don't want to keep you too much longer because you have to go to rehearsal. Can I ask just quickly?
Yeah.
What is your family's relation to you being an artist and being in the theater?
Yeah. They're great. They're totally cool with it. They're very supportive.
It's always made sense to them.
Yeah, it's totally made sense to them. That's awesome. I think it was never a surprise, because I was always interested in the arts, and I was always, I told you I had this ballet phase, I had an opera phase, I had a repertory company of stuffed animals.
Yes.
But, like, actually, like, a repertory company. Like, this was, like, a 6-year thing. Like, they all had, and they all had personalities, they all had, there were specific kind of roles that, like, the specific animals were suited for. Like,
obviously, the polar bear. Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there was a killer whale, and he was usually the villain. There was a little cat who was an ingenue, and her boyfriend, the tiger, was, usually the leading man. So it was all very, and there was manufactured offstage drama. Like, I had really, like, created this whole world. Exactly. I think they knew exactly what was going on. But yeah, I mean, their material evolved too as I got older. You know, it was like, first it was the Nutcracker, and then it was like Andrew Lloyd Webber, and I think they had to sit through Phantom of the Opera with stuffed animals once.
Of course.
I mean, bless them. So yes, they've always been very supportive, and my dad is a bishop in the Episcopal Church.
That's right.
And I think that actually that growing up in the church had a huge influence on the path that I ended up taking.
It's so presentational. It's so performative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ritual of the liturgy. it's a spectacle.
And that same thing we were talking about, like, bringing community together.
Yes,
and, like,
telling
a story.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all the reasons that, I mean, reasons that people go to church.
Yeah.
I'd go to theater.
Exactly.
And make theater. It can be when you have that electric energy that feels like a congregation almost, you know, and
yeah.
I mean, without getting too much into where my own spirituality resides these days, I think there is something sacred, in gathering a group of people together, to watch, and to live through and share human experience together.
Yeah.
In whatever form you do that.
Are there any concrete things you find yourself turning to again and again when you are going to the dark side and there's a book you read over and over again, or an album, or a place you go?
Greenwood Cemetery. It's weird. You're like, where do you go when you encounter the dark side? A cemetery. But I find cemeteries weirdly soothing.
Well, there's like a reverence there.
Yeah. It feels calm. There's usually not many people around, and it just feels like a quiet space, but also the energy of everyone else who is there for, you know, hundreds of years of people who are there. And so it feels like a place that I can at once be completely alone with my thoughts and not alone. Whereas it's sort of the opposite of what a lot of New York can feel like sometimes, which is being surrounded by people,
anonymous in a crowd,
but completely alone.
Yeah.
I don't know. I get the opposite feeling of that in Greenwood. It's like, I'm alone, but spiritually I'm not. So that's a place for sure. I don't know about specific books, but I usually try if I have time. Unfortunately now I don't have time, but I usually have a book going, like a novel, or short stories or something. It just helps me to live in somebody else's world, for a while.
Take the focus off of yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And music.
I know you've been super busy. Have you seen any shows recently you want to give a shout out to?
Recently, I can't even remember the last piece of theater that I saw. Oh, well, I saw Lear de Bessonnet's staging of the Odyssey at the Delacorte in the Public Works program, and also her Winter's Tale last year. And I think that program, and her work in general, but that program in particular, is the most extraordinary thing. She has pulled together many different community groups from all five boroughs, and it's an amazing mix of professional actors and just people. There's senior centers and youth choirs, and you know, an Indian dance company, a Chinese dance company.
I wish I had seen it.
Yeah, it's what I feel like that theater is for, and like what the public is really for. But it's a remarkable feeling to be sitting in at the Delacorte and to have it be full. And the crowd is so present because it's full of people. There's hundreds of people on stage. There are literally hundreds of people on stage. And where can you see that?
Yeah.
Where else can you see that? I mean, you don't get that on Broadway even.
Nobody will fund that.
No.
Commercials.
Yeah, and so I'm so grateful to Oscar Eustace and to Lear for creating this thing, because it's so joyous. It feels like it truly belongs to everyone, and everyone who's there feels involved. And the stories that they've chosen, you know, either Shakespeare and Homer, it's, you know, these things that, and in really making them feel like they really belong to everybody. And the crowd is so diverse, such an amazing mix of ages and people from all over the city. It's really that those two shows have been some of my favorite experiences in the theater.
do you want to just give a little spiel about the tower before we sign off here? About how and where and when people can come see it?
Yes, absolutely. So the tower is being presented by my company, Antimatter Collective, at HERE Arts Center. Our run begins on December 4th, Friday, December 4th, and runs through Saturday the 19th. You can go to here.org for tickets, or to our website, antimattercollective.org. Yeah, it's a psychedelic journey into the history of the Donner Party, which it's both very dark and very hopeful, I think. So,
well, we'll be having a good time. Yeah, so we'll hope everybody can join us.
I hope so too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sorry we have to end this.
It was lovely. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.